Oh, the
Taylor.
I was asking you about the meetings, the bar meetings. And you said they met twice a day at the Model Cafe.
Yeah.
Did they conduct any business?
No. It was just a social. The bar lunch itself was held, and I'm not sure which day of the week, but probably like on a Friday maybe,
mm-hmm.
at noon, and at which time there would be, you know, a business meeting of such a sorts. Probably wasn't a whole lot to do, but every once in a while, I remember them, you know, they would discuss matters of legislation, and if the legislature was in session or going to be in session, they would talk about court calendars and, you know, things that lawyers talk about when they get together. The other times, I guess, were just, you know, social. If the fish were in season, you know, where are the fish biting? You know, what are you doing this weekend? Or, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Did they endorse political candidates?
No.
Never?
No. Seemed to me like the bar was pretty well evenly divided, you know, between Republicans and Democrats. And I don't recall really that politics may not have been a burning issue as far as, you know, discussions. And maybe it might get heated at time, you know, maybe around election time. But I seriously doubt that it was an ongoing, everyday kind of a thing that they discussed.
Yeah.
I'm sure that they never did endorse any candidates. I'm almost positive that they never did do that.
Did lawyers belong to a lot of professional organizations where they would meet clients and that sort of thing?
Well, those that were on the upper, with that, what they used to call upward mobility, I'm sure did.
What would they join?
The Rotary Club, the service clubs, you know, the Rotary Club, the Lions, and the Elks, and of course the Elks, I guess, is not, well, it could be, I guess. The Rotary was the, what is it they say about the three service organizations, the Rotary and the Lions and the, what's the other one?
JC?
One of them, let's see, what is it they say about the one group works in the town, the other one, I can't remember, but they end up with the Rotary owning it. The Rotary owns the town. Of course, usually the money people, and maybe the Rotary Club was the top club to belong to. You know, if you belong to that, you're in with all the money people, and whether, you know, and, you know, why do people join organizations, you know? Personally, I've never been a joiner, and so I don't try to assess, you know, my personal philosophy has always been that I did not want to join an organization unless I could be active in it. And so therefore I'm not a joiner. I don't join something just to be, you know, say that, gee, I am this, you know, Rotarian or Lion or whatever.
Which attorneys on the list were the ones that joined a lot of the organizations?
I think Ralph Rivers was quite active in a lot of things like that. But Ralph Rivers was a politician too. Walker, I'm sure, did a lot of things like that. You know, I really don't know, because not being, you know, involved in that thing and not going to those meetings, and you don't know, I don't know who goes now,
yeah,
of the lawyers. So I've never, you know, if I've ever been invited, to join, I've forgotten about it,
mm-hmm.
Because I say it never interested me that much. But so which lawyers here go, I really couldn't tell you, and so I can't tell you,
yeah,
where we used to go.
Did you ever get involved in, you said you ran for borough office and things like that. Did a lot of lawyers get involved in politics? That your father was, and you just,
yeah,
a little. Was it something that that lawyers
Well, like my dad and McNeely, Gene Miller, Maurice Johnson, Ralph Rivers, Mike Stepovich, Ted Stevens,
did it hurt their practices?
So, you know, I often wondered about that because a lot of them were solo practitioners and they were gone from here for a period of time, and you wonder what would happen to their practices. My dad always had somebody with him, it wasn't a matter of closing the practice, you know, and not being around. But the other attorneys that didn't have anybody with them, I guess it must have been, to leave. Matter of fact, there were statutes before, and I don't know if they're still in the books, I kind of doubt it, but there were statutes before to protect lawyers that the courts couldn't do anything in relation to those lawyers' clients that the lawyer was serving the legislature.
Okay.
No. I remember that now.
So you couldn't do anything to the client?
That's
the
right.
Lawyer was
that's right. The case couldn't. They couldn't have any proceedings against that in that case until that lawyer returned from the legislature.
And the legislature passed that.
Oh, sure. Why not? Because it was always, you know, there are always a lot of lawyers in the legislature,
yeah.
And it sounds good, I suppose, you know, to even anybody else, you know, well, I'm here in the legislature, why should the court require, you know, my client to go get another attorney? And that sounds, it's a very valid reason, you know, to the layperson.
Did lawyers have problems with their image in the community if they were involved in politics?
I don't think so.
Did criminal lawyers have a hard time being involved in politics? Wendell Kay had a hard time from Anchorage.
And in what respect?
Well, I think he attributes his criminal practice to not letting him not being an acceptable candidate for governor, although he had a lot of name recognition.
Well, being governor is one thing, but being a member of the, you know, the Senate or the House of Representatives is something else. And like George McNabb served, George was quite a defense lawyer, and George served in the legislature. Of course, I guess he was ultimately either disbarred or suspended. I haven't heard him for a long time. Bob McNeely was, although he'd been in the prosecutor's office, also was doing defense work at the time when he was elected time after time to the legislature.
So in Fairbanks, they didn't hold it against someone if they had a criminal practice?
I don't think so. You know, and I look at the list and I can't see any, you know, that people that may have, you know, been totally on the defense bar and were never in the, I think we're running out of names is what we're doing. We don't have enough names here to work from.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were a lot more than this, and someplace we've got to get the list, you know, get a complete list of all the lawyers, and of course I tend to look at a much larger list because I tend to not want to stop at 1955 or 1960 or something like that. I tend to run it right into, you know, to the present date.
Yeah.
And I know you're not asking me to cut it off at any particular date, but I'm trying to think of things that happened back in the, you know, in the 50s. Things that happened in the 60s we can talk about next year.
Right.
Yeah. The 50s are different. Who were the attorneys that were here in the 1950s? I just think the list was larger than that. So, and there could have been attorneys, of course, there are attorneys that may have come and gone and they weren't here that long, and they may have practiced and they may have gone to the legislature. I doubt that it would, you know, I don't think it bothered to practice except the fact that they were gone, and I don't think that their image was tarnished because of the fact that they were on the criminal bar.
Was George Bixby up again?
George was. I did see George practice in Fairbanks a couple of times. Now, if George in the early years had been here longer, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I know that he'd spent time in Nome, And that's just by somebody told me that he'd been in Nome, that he practiced out of the Board of Trade up there. That I saw him in Anchorage, and I saw him here in Fairbanks. I knew that he lived in Anchorage up to the time that he died. After, if he ever lived in Fairbanks, it would have certainly had to have been before I came here.
Yeah. What was your impression of him?
An older man, the dean of the bar, highly respected, brilliant lawyer, tremendous trial practitioner, I guess.
Was he friendly with your father at all?
I think they got along very well. As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, there may have been a case that he and my dad were together on up here, a criminal case.
Uh-huh.
And I that's just a recollection that I seem to have, but without knowing any names.
Yeah. Did your dad associate with other lawyers that outside of Fairbanks?
Mm-hmm.
On a regular, who?
Well, I think I'm sure that he and Wendell Kay must have had some practice. He's had some cases together, because they were both... Both he and Wendell did a lot of criminal work, and then once in a while they get a big case and they, you know, work together and maybe have multiple clients or something, or several joint defendants. My dad practiced or did some work with Julian Hurley. He and Fred Crane worked together in different matters.
Any other people outside of Fairbanks that he worked with?
I can't think of any. I think mostly it was probably... Most of the cases that he had in later years, he was doing it on his own, but the earlier times, I know that, I'd say Wendell Kay and, George McNabb was working with my dad, so that wouldn't have been really have, you know, somebody else's.
Can I bring you to the court bar fight, just to go over that fast?
Okay.
How did Fairbanks feel about the court bar fight?
I think that the Fairbanks attorneys.
Yeah.
The bar was not unified in Fairbanks on this point. I'm not really sure on how the division was at the time. It wasn't even. I think that more attorneys were in favor or were against Nesbitt's position. I used Nesbitt's position because he being the Chief Justice at the time, and advocated that the Bar Association, took the Bar Association side of it rather than the court side of it. And I think as a result of it, of course, it was the activities of the several bar associations throughout the state, I think, that advocated. And unfortunately, and you'll look back on it, it was really a tragedy that the only person that was available to, for the bar to, in the vernacular, to get even with or to make a point with was Justice Aaron, probably the nicest person you'd ever want to know. And as a result of it, he was defeated at the election, and that was the bar had something had to give, I suppose, with the forces that were coming together, and they had this Glenn Winters from the Judicature Society came up and kind of refereed, and they finally come to an agreed settlement. They had some pretty high-powered attorneys on both sides. I recall the fellow's name Ball from San Francisco or Los Angeles, wherever he's from, and was representing the bar, and I can't remember who represented the court system.
Man from Washington, D.C., I can't remember his name either.
Yeah, and it was, it would have been, an extremely bitter divisive fight. It would have been a terrible thing to, you know, to have gone to its to the bitter end. And the settlement, I'm sure, was accepted. You know, it was time. It came at the right time. Maybe it's too bad it did come earlier, but because, like I say, Justice Aaron got caught in the clinch there, and he's not the person that deserved it. But the what, you know, that's how many years ago now? What years were that? Was that?
About 63
to 65. When I was appointed in 65, and it was a result of Aaron having, you know, been removed from the bench, and Rabinowitz was, I guess he was disgusted with the court system and had resigned from the Superior Court, and it just came out about the same time, you know, that Aaron was released or removed from office, and that left a vacancy there, and so he gave that a shot, and I gave this a shot. Mm-hmm. And I suppose maybe it's a result of the bar fights, you know, that here I am and here there he is. But
had he resigned during the bar fight?
Well, like, seemed like he had resigned. You know, timing was maybe important now, but it may not have meant anything to me at the time back then. And it seemed to me that he might have resigned before, and it couldn't have been much time before, considering the timing that it takes, you know, to get because both came up at the same time. Bill Bogus and I were in practice together. And Bill had put in for the Supreme Court, and I had applied for the Superior Court. And we did this at the same time. Our practice was in limbo. You talk about, you know, going to the legislature. We decided that we would not take on a case. We sat through and Bill's a great baseball fan, and no television at that time. And we'd sit there and listen to the radio all day long, or work these double crostics from the Saturday Review of Literature magazine. And make up our own, you know. This is all we were doing all day long, because we couldn't. We maybe go to court once in a while on a pending case or something, but we were not taking any new clients, because, you know, why take on something and then have to dump it? Mm-hmm. That was our feeling. Well, Bill was not selected, and I was. But Jay and I were called on the same day, and like he said, you know, we both had unlisted telephones, and the governor, he had to call. I can't remember who he called. Who did he call to get a hold of me? Called the police department. And I don't know how, I'm not sure how I got a hold of Jay, but that's how I got notification of the police department. Says, I answered the phone, and will you please call Governor Egan? But that was the bar fight, but timing as to whether or not he actually resigned, and I'd almost have to believe that he had resigned before the general election of the fall, when the Heron would have been on, you know.
When did you start working with Bogus?
I was in the district attorney's office for 2 years. Mm-hmm. From the time we started January maybe of 59, for 2 years, and then I went to work for Bogus. I'm with Bogus in a partnership. And then I worked with him for up until probably about 3 years, I guess. Mm-hmm. 60, maybe sometime in 62 to sometime in 65. And I was, like, in February or something, it was sometime in February that I was appointed, and I waited 30 days before I went on the bench. I could have gone on right away, but I decided to take a vacation from the last 3 or 4 months that I hadn't been doing anything.
Had Bogus had any partners before you?
No.
So you were the first partner that he'd ever had. Mm-hmm. Were there any other people who were getting partners at that point?
I think McNeely and Murdy's, Bob McNeely and Ed Murdy's were in the partnership at that time. Mm-hmm. I guess even back then it was in the in the late 50s and early 60s, there probably still weren't any firms as we know them now. I know that Rice Hoppner didn't get started until quite a bit later than that. I'm trying to think of some of the firms now that... some of these people weren't even alive back then, I think. Like the firm of Hughes Thorsness, you know, they were in Anchorage for many years, but then it wasn't until more recent years that they were up here. And Birch Horton, and that's a Birch Horton's outfit is a creature of the pipeline days.
They were doing prepaid legal services, that
with Birch Horton? I think, yeah, with one of the unions. You know, I'm not sure if Charlie and Dick were in partnership together or not. For a short period of time when I was in the DA's office, Dick came to work as an assistant for a short period of time. And then I'm not sure if he and Charlie went into a partnership, if it was Cole and Cole or something in the back of my mind seemed to tell me that that may have happened back then.
Could you look at pipeline time and say that that was a point when it started to really...
I think the money made the difference then, that was just the things had gone down quite a bit. I'm sure that practices were not flourishing at the time, pre-pipeline.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until they started building, and there was a tremendous influx of people and businesses and money, and that then the big firms started forming up and getting into it.
Yeah.
Like Tom Fenton, Tom is not that new here, but he's not that old either. I've known Tom Fenton for a long time, but I don't know if it goes back into the 50s. I kind of doubt it. I think Tom is maybe... he might be the later 50s.
Did the practice of law change up here? Has there been a transition from the way people practiced in the 50s to the way people practice now?
The rules changed. The federal rules changed practice a lot. I think that like my dad and Julian Hurley and people like that, that, you know, the old time practitioners had practiced under an entirely different set of, you know, rules. Mm-hmm. And then the federal rules were adopted, which became the source book for practice in the territory and the federal system. And then as rules were modified and changed and became more uniform in practice, you could, I suspect that depending on which judge you were before, made a lot of difference. But after the uniform rules came in, I think that the practice pretty well standardized itself. And I think that when the federal rules came out, 43 or something like that, my recollection, certainly correct. Whenever they came in, but then Alaska, being a federal stepchild and taking the federal rules, and then it was just natural that when you learn to work with those rules, that that's what you adopt in essence, and that's what we have now. We are more or less acting under a modified or a state adopted federal rule system.
Do you know anything about the background of Julian Hurley?
No. I know that he'd been here a long time. I remember people talking about what a good dog musher he was in the early days. And,
had he gone to law school?
I'm sure that Julian had, but I can't tell you where and why. And if I said Idaho, and that's only because something flashes through my mind like that, and I don't know why I think of Idaho.
Yeah.
I could be wrong. I don't know. You know, it's interesting, you asked a little while ago about people coming to Alaska maybe to get away from something else. And maybe you don't know about a lot of backgrounds. You know, why did somebody come to Alaska? Now, maybe they left a real flourishing practice in Baltimore, Ohio, or New York City, or something like that. Why did it come to Alaska? And people just don't ask. They don't care. Now, you prove yourself, and you do something wrong here, then you can, you know, then you make your mark. But until you do that, you'll be accepted.
But they do ask, when did you come to Alaska?
When did you come to Alaska?
How long have you been here?
Of course, the person will always give them the wrong information.
Were your father was a fairly liberal lawyer. Talking about liberals in the old sense of the word liberal. Mm-hmm. Were there a lot of lawyers like?
Matter
of
fact, he advocated, and I think was success probably singularly successful in having the death penalty mm-hmm. abolished. Yeah. You know, he was against that.
Were there other lawyers who were equally liberal in his time period? Or were they not as liberal?
Oh, I'm sure that they were. I think, you know, just like in any cut through a slice of society, and you're going to find people on both sides of that coin, mm-hmm. On both parameters.
Well, you take a Juno, very few liberal lawyers.
Well, maybe that's because of the type of a community you have here. You have a community that's settled in. Mm-hmm. They've got they're not a transient population. Fairbanks, unfortunately, there's not too many people that you can look back, and that's why you look at a list, you know, in there, and you say, gee, yeah, that, you know, there's some of those people maybe still alive, you know, where are they? Mm-hmm. And you think of people that you've known over the years, you know, and where are they? Well, they're not here, they've gone someplace. I suspect Anchorage is probably a lot like Fairbanks in that regard. People are too mobile, and the community doesn't lend itself maybe to a sense of permanency, whereas Juneau and Ketchikan and Sitka, more or less isolated, and maybe these are the places that people set down roots.
Why is it so transient here? Why was it? Is it?
It's the idea that I suppose it because you've got roads in and out of the place.
Is it still as transient as it used to be?
I think so. I think that there are people that are here and have been here for a long time and probably will stay here forever. But there are still a lot of people that are here for a few years and then they go. An attorney came into court today for the district assistant district attorney, and name is Bill Mackey, and I had been assigned to Kodiak a few years ago to try a couple of cases down there, and Bill Mackey was prosecuting. And I asked, when we finished with court this morning, I asked him, I said, I thought maybe you were just up here to fill in, you know, for a while. And he said, no, he said, after 7 years on the rock, he said, and he'd been in Kodiak, he said, that I've just had enough, and he said, I decided to make the move, and Fairbanks was available. And he said, the family decided we'd like to go to Fairbanks. And I said, well, you know, thinking about the rock, he said, talking about making jokes about Kodiak and the Hawaiian Islands, he says, Kodiak has been known as as the northernmost island in the Hawaiian group.
Would you say that there was more of a chance for liberal lawyers in Anchorage and Fairbanks than there was
in
Juneau?
I'm sure that they were. Yeah, this community, I think both Fairbanks and Anchorage absorbed a lot more liberal lawyers than Southeastern would have to because of the smaller community for them. Mm-hmm. Now, whether or not government lawyers and I think government lawyers may tend to be a little more liberal. In a lot of sense, the environmental lawyers and people like that, that Juneau may have absorbed a lot more than we think that they did, because there are so many more lawyers in government service that really have nothing to do with the bar association or the law practice, in a visible law practice type of thing. You know, they don't have an office someplace, and they're not known as that he is a lawyer.
Yeah.
They may know that he's a lawyer working for the government, but that doesn't mean that he's a lawyer working for a living, in the sense of the word that he's using his tools to, you know, carve out a living. He's on the government door.
One last question. Were there any people who supported Aaron from Fairbanks?
Oh, sure. Oh, you bet.
Who are Aaron supporting?
I can't think of any names right now, but I remember somebody brought a paper in here the other day, and they'd been cleaning out some old desk around here, or old filing cabinet or something. I don't know where that paper went. If Edna were here, she knows where everything is. Even on this desk, she knows where everything is. It talked about the bar. It talked about, at that time, it mentioned, it was an article about Harry Aaron dying. There was an article also in there about Justice Rabinowitz being named as Chief Justice. I can't remember exactly, but maybe I've seen more than one paper. But there were other papers that I've also seen recently, and it mentioned about the bar fight, and it mentioned about the letters to the editor were vicious, from both sides, and attacking this poor man. And substantial people in the community were in Aaron's, on his side. Not because of the bar fight, but because of the person that they were dealing with. This person was beyond reproach. That he did not deserve to be attacked by the Bar Association. The people in the Bar Association that did attack him were a bunch of scoundrels, for doing this. I wish I could name names, and I'm sure if I had somebody here, that was involved in that at the time, we could start naming names.
Well, Grace Scheibel said that she was for Aaron.
I'm sure.
And that Jeff was for Aaron. So those are the only two I've heard.
Oh, gosh. Pam, I'm sure that there must have been others. There had to be. He was not without his supporters, but I think that Chuck Clasby had. Maybe not. Chuck was an enigma to me at the time because he may have been ambivalent about that, and he may have been. Supporting the position of the bar, they're going back too far in my recollection. He may have been supporting the bar position, but he also may at the same time had sympathies with Aaron. Mm-hmm. I also have a reason to believe that he took an active part against Aaron.
Was there a lot of pressure from other bars, from the Anchorage Bar, the Juno Bar, the Unified Bar?
There was not pressure, but there was a concert of effort amongst the bar associations. This is what divided, the vote. I'm not even sure how close the vote was, but it was obvious enough to remove him. I don't know. I guess it's a period of time that I don't really have that good of a recollection. But the thing about that particular incident was that there was so much written in the papers about it. That and of course a person's recollections, I'm sure, are valuable. But my recollection of it was that it was pretty vicious, and the attacks were I don't know that I've not seen anything in anything in present day bar activities that even get close to it. And I just, I'd hate to see it happen again. It was unfortunate it happened then.
How long did it take for them afterward?
I think after the settlement was done and the sides were satisfied that of the respective positions, that I think things came back together pretty quickly. Again, in hindsight, it might have taken a long time, but we're talking about 20 years ago, and things tend to compress themselves in time, and maybe it wasn't so, such a brief episode. Maybe it was a longer healing process, but I don't recall that there were any that if there were people on either side of it or with regard to the court, if there were issues that remained festering, I don't think that there were. If there were, I certainly wasn't aware of it. Nothing that I recall, and nobody ever, maybe because I went on the bench right away, and my general association with the Bar Association was more or less severed. And maybe I wasn't privy to the information. It was an ongoing, conflict.
Thank you.
Which is going to be coming down from the Supreme Court, and there's a collateral source argument in there. The engineering company argues that they should be entitled to a reduction in the judgment against them because the city of Seward never paid the money to hire the engineers in the first place. It was a federal grant project with the city of Seward paying 10% and the state paying 25% and the federal government paying 75%. So since the city of Seward paid only 10%, the city's recovery should be limited to 10% of what it paid out. That's the argument. I don't think it's going to fly. Excuse me? Okay, collateral source is something that you should be aware of because it is something which may be hit on a bar exam question. Punitive damages in the state of Alaska. There must be actual malice and the showing of actual damages. Punitive damages are kind of interesting in the state of Alaska. Prejudgment interest is not made on punitive damage awards. Do not have prejudgment interest on punitive damages. Attorney's fees, not terribly clear, but probably not. There, yes? I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. You can get it on punitive awards. Okay, there are a couple of Day versus Sturm-Ruger cases, three Day versus Sturm-Ruger cases, which talk about punitive damages backwards and forwards. Punitive damages are available in products liability cases, as set forth in the supplement. The last, or the second last, Day versus Sturm-Ruger case. I'm sorry, it's not in the supplement. That's set forth under products liability. But punitive damages are available in products liability cases, and the language which was used by the Supreme Court in that particular case was that punitive damages were available where the manufacturer knew that the product was defectively designed and that the manufacturer knew that injuries and deaths had resulted from the product and that the manufacturer continued to market the product anyway. Punitive damages were available in that fact situation. However, the award made in the particular Day versus Ruger case was $2,895,000 in punitive damages. That was calculated by multiplying the figure of $1.93, which was the cost for installing the safety device on each of Sturm Ruger's single action revolvers, times the number of revolvers it sold within a certain period of time. $1.93, which would have put the safety device on, times the amount of the number of revolvers sold, reached the $2,895,000 figure. The Supreme Court reduced the Day versus Ruger number one. The Supreme Court, yes. Oh, sure. Okay, in Day versus Ruger number one, the Supreme Court reduced the punitive damage award to $250,000 as being as a result of passion and prejudice. In Day versus Ruger number two, the Supreme Court said, we were wrong in Day versus Ruger number one. It wasn't really as a result of passion and prejudice. It wasn't really $250,000. It should be $500,000 because it was excessive. Now, all during the course of this case, the Sturm Ruger has been arguing that punitive damages is unconstitutional because there are no standards set upon which punishment can be imposed and that this is a violation of due process, analogizing to criminal cases requiring notice and standards and that type of thing. What the Supreme Court has basically done is proven that Sturm Ruger is right, and Sturm Ruger has taken the case up to the United States Supreme Court on constitutional, the question of punitive damages in itself has been taken up by Sturm Ruger to the U.S. Supreme Court on constitutional grounds. I don't know if the Supreme Court will hear it or not. If there's any single case where punitive damages is the sexy issue to be looked at by the U.S. Supreme Court, this is it. Because the lower court, the Supreme Court of Alaska, could not even agree on how to apply punitive damages. There's also another question in this case, and that's how do you treat punitive damages when you have a multiplicity of lawsuits? Sturm Ruger had not only this day lawsuit, but they have lawsuits against them all over the country resulting from this particular revolver. They have half a dozen lawsuits in the state of Alaska resulting from this particular revolver. The particular attorney who tried the case for Day has a number of lawsuits involving this particular revolver. And how do you handle it when the defendant is punished in the first case for what he did? Does he get a multiplicity of punishments in the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth case, etc.? So that question again makes it a sexy question for the U.S. Supreme Court to look at if the Supreme Court does want to. Okay, off the subject of damages, and we'll be running through some of these next subjects kind of quickly. Owners and Occupiers of Land, page 14. One case to remember, or one principle to remember, Webb versus City and Borough of Sitka. Classification of trespasser, licensee, and invitee to determine the duty of a landowner to one entering upon the land is abolished. We no longer have in Alaska trespassers, licensees, and invitee classifications. We look at general negligence again. The landowner must act as a reasonable person in maintaining his property in a reasonable condition in view of all the circumstances. Likelihood of injury, etc., burden of avoiding the risk, all the types of things that go into general negligence. A former possessor of land is not liable for injuries unless he actually concealed or failed to disclose to his buyer, the present possessor, what the condition was which would involve the unreasonable risk. And the present possessor does not know about the condition. Past possessor has a duty to disclose something he knew about, and you look at it again in terms of general negligence principles. The Webb versus City and Borough of Sitka case dealt with a lady who tripped over some cracks in the sidewalk at the city of Sitka. There are older cases in the state of Alaska dealing with the city of Anchorage, and they hold that Anchorage has no obligation to remove natural accumulations of ice and snow from the sidewalks of the city of Anchorage because there's a lot of snow, it falls all the time, there's a lot of sidewalks, that type of thing. I would suggest that even though the case does hold that, the older cases, that you still have to, you won't get to that result as a matter of law anymore. You'll still have to look at it in light of general negligence principles, i.e. should the city of Anchorage have moved the snow, removed the snow, look at it that way. Comparative negligence. An important area of law which you will see on the bar exam almost certainly. Comparative negligence principles are not too hard in the state of Alaska. In 1975, contributory negligence was rejected in the state of Alaska, and the pure form of comparative negligence was adopted by judicial decision. That was in the case of Katz versus State. That's another of the old friends here that you should know by name, Katz, K-A-A-T-Z. When the Supreme Court decided Katz and adopted pure comparative negligence by a judicial decision, which, by the way, I think was only the second jurisdiction in the United States to adopt comparative negligence by judicial decision. Some of the other states had adopted comparative negligence of one form or another by statute. But I think California was the first by judicial decision, and then Alaska followed California. Katz's case was followed in quite a few cases after that. In cases both before and after, specific defenses, in addition to contributory negligence, were disposed of. We no longer have the defense of last clear chance in Alaska. The fact that the person had the last clear chance to avoid the accident is simply something which is to be taken into account in determining comparative negligence. We also do not have the doctrine of assumption of risk in Alaska. Assumption of risk was disposed of even prior to comparative negligence in the contributory negligence sense, and the court held that assumption of risk is also something to be taken into account in the comparative negligence analysis. Now, there's some problem. Yes?
By comparative negligence, you're saying that the plaintiff is found to be 90% responsible for the injury. He gets
10%
of the total cost.
He gets 10%, right. Right, that's pure comparative negligence. Right, and there's a problem in the assumption of risk area, because assumption of risk and comparative negligence are philosophically two entirely different things. And it's difficult to lump them together as a matter of philosophy, because one really doesn't have to do with negligence. One has to do with assumption of risk is putting yourself in the dangerous position knowing what you're doing, or you should have known what you were doing and putting yourself in that position. It doesn't really have anything to do with the accident itself taking place, proximate cause of the accident. You merely placed yourself in the position of danger. So philosophically, that's different from from negligence and proximate cause, but the Supreme Court has lumped them together and said that you look at everything that happened, basically, in calculating the comparison of negligence between the parties. Last clear chance, by the way, can be argued as a matter of advocacy in closing argument, i.e. the person was more negligent because he had the last clear chance to avoid the accident and he didn't. That can be said properly. Or that the person assumed the risk of doing this and therefore he's more negligent. It's proper to argue that, too. But the separate defenses, assumption of risk and last clear chance, are not available for instruction to the jury. Now, no specific guidelines are set forth by the court for apportioning negligence. The best guidelines they have set forth are set forth on the bottom of page 15 of the outline, which came from COTS 2. And they're set forth as a matter of making the apportionment process a little bit more concrete. You can take a look at them, but basically they deal with the probability of the harm occurring and the accident taking place, the foreseeability of the harm and the accident in the eyes of the people who were involved, what was gained by each party by doing what it was that he did, and whether there were reasonable alternatives available. Comparative negligence in Alaska is pure form. Basically, if the plaintiff is a percentage negligent, the plaintiff's entire damages are reduced by that portion of negligence attributable to the plaintiff. Logically here, skip in the outline a little bit, it's logical to go from comparative negligence to the subject of contribution and joint and several liability. That begins on page 23 of the outline. Subject of contribution and joint and several liability is a little bit complicated in Alaska. It's basically governed by the Uniform Contribution Among Joint Tortfeasors Act, which is available to you in the statutory supplement, 0916010. Please read this and become familiar with it before you go into the bar examination. I believe that the Contribution Among Joint Tortfeasors Act is a complicated enough and sexy enough area to write an excellent bar examination question on it. Running down the statute, 0916010, there is a right of contribution between defendants whether or not judgment has been entered against both defendants. The right of contribution exists only in the favor of a tortfeasor who's paid more than his pro rata share of the common liability. Now, you go further down into the statute that defines pro rata share. And basically, in determining pro rata share between joint tortfeasor defendants, you do not consider the relative degree of fault. Okay? Example, plaintiff defendant 1 and defendant 2. Plaintiff is 50% negligent, defendant 2 is 30% negligent, defendant 1 is 20% negligent. Pro rata share between the two defendants is not based on that 30-20 split, because that's the apportionment of the negligence between them. Pro rata share is equal. Okay? Pro rata share between defendants is to be determined without regard to the fault of the defendants. This is set forth in the statute. It's also set forth in the case of Arctic Structures versus Wedmore. In addition to not considering the relative degrees of fault between the defendants, the collective liability of a group of defendants can be considered as a single share if equity requires that. This is the statutory language, and I have never seen a case, either in practice or before the Alaska Supreme Court, where this has been applied, that the collective liability of a group was classed as a single share. Yes?
Can a defendant get indemnity?
There is another section in here, F, which talks about the chapter does not impair any right of indemnity under existing law. If one tortfeasor is entitled to indemnity from another, the right of the there is still a right of indemnity and not contribution. So you still have a right of indemnity independent from the statute. And if you do have the right of indemnity, that's not limited by anything in the statute. So the right of indemnity is still available. On determining pro rata shares, again, there's another thing which talks about the principles of equity applicable to contribution generally shall apply. And I don't know why they put that in or what that means. It just says it. I don't think it means that, though. No. I think that it might mean that grouping, if equity requires the collective liability of some as a group constitutes a single share. Okay, it doesn't mean that you're going to drop out the guy who's 5% negligent.
What if you had two that were 5 and one that was 90? Couldn't you group the two that were 5 as a single share?
If equity required it, you might be able to. Yeah, but again, you know, all I can tell you is what the statute says. There are no cases. As we go down the right to contribution, there's no right to contribution in favor of any tortfeasor, as we discussed before, in intentional torts, who intentionally caused or contributed to the injury. If the person did it intentionally, either as an intentional tort or as something which would be deemed intentional in the area of negligence, i.e., that's not really the right way to say it, but which would be deemed intentional by, example again, I guess, being very far, driving your automobile at 60 miles an hour into a crowded group of pedestrians, something which would be really gross negligence, which would rise to the level of being intentional. Again, I've never seen any of those cases. Liability insurer, which you won't get on the bar exam, it's subrogated to the tortfeasor's right of contribution if the liability insurer has paid. There's another principle here which you should be familiar with, section 0916040, and that deals with releases and covenants not to sue. When a release or covenant not to sue is given in good faith to one of two or more joint liability defendants liable in tort for the same injury, it does not discharge the other tortfeasors for liability unless its terms so provide, that the release reduces the claim against the others by the amount of the release or the amount of the consideration paid for the release. Okay, if you settle with one joint tortfeasor, as a plaintiff, your claim against the other joint tortfeasors is reduced by that amount. However, there's a quid pro quo for that for the settling tortfeasor, and that's the tortfeasor who settles is released from liability for contribution to any of the other tortfeasors. If a defendant settles with the plaintiff in good faith, the plaintiff's claim is reduced, and the tortfeasor has protected himself from contribution claims by the other defendants. The tortfeasor who settles is out, and the other defendants can't come after him for contribution. They could still come after him for indemnity, however, because indemnity is not affected by the contribution statute. There are certain limitations in here which I won't go over in detail, which have to do with times. for enforcement of contribution. Contribution oftentimes is enforced by a separate action. Indemnity is oftentimes enforced by a separate action, rather than by raising it as an issue in the action brought by the plaintiff. There's a practical reason for this, because when a number of defendants are involved in litigation with the plaintiff, they all want to present a united front. The defendants want to sit down and all point at the plaintiff and say, you did it, it's your fault. The plaintiff would rather have all the defendants in there pointing at each other. And the defendants don't want to do that. So even if you have the indemnity and contribution issues in the same action, very often they'll be settled or separated out in some way so that it's simply plaintiff versus all the defendants jointly. If you'll give me 1 minute here to change the tape.